friends, I came to know, the deep story was a response to a real squeeze. On the one hand, the national ideal and promise at the brow of the hill was the American dream, which is to say, progress. On the other hand, it had become hard to progress. As an ideal, the American dream proposed a right way of feeling. You should feel hopeful, energetic, focused, mobilized. Progress, its core idea, didn't go with feeling confused or mournful. And as an ideal, the American dream did not seem to guide people in what to feel when they had attained some of their goals but not others. A state inspiring a more cautious impulse to protect what you already have. Progress had also become harder, more chancy, and more restricted to a small elite. The Great Recession of 2008, in which people lost homes, savings, and jobs, had come and gone, but it had shaken people up. Meanwhile, for the bottom 90% of Americans, the dream machine, invisible over the brow of the hill, had stopped due to automation, offshoring, and the growing power of multinationals vis-a-vis their workforces. At the same time, for that 90%, competition between white men and everyone else had increased for jobs, for recognition, and for government funds. The year when the dream stopped working for the 90% was 1950. If you were born before 1950, on average, the older you got, the more your income rose. If you were born after 1950, it did not. In fact, as economist Philip Longman argues, they are the first generation in American history to experience the kind of lifetime downward mobility in which at every stage of adult life they have less income and less net wealth than people their age 10 years before. Some become so discouraged they stop looking for work. Since the 1960s, the share of men ages 25 to 54 no longer in the workforce has tripled. This stalled American dream hits many on the right at a particularly vulnerable season of life, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. It is a time during which people often check their bucket list, take stock, and are sometimes forced to give up certain dreams of youth. It's a season of life in which a person says to him or herself, "So, this is it." As one man told me, "I thought one day I'd meet the girl of my dreams. I haven't, and now I don't see her coming into my life." Another man had hoped to start his own swamp tour company, but wasn't able to get it off the ground. Yet another had hoped to travel to rodeo shows around the South, but got sick. Who could one blame for such disappointments? Oneself, of course, but that only increases your intense focus on your place in line. Age also meant age discrimination. Older men now in their 60s were the first to experience the diminishing American dream, either by virtue of their lack of up-to-date training or because of company reluctance to pay age-related higher wages. But where were those federally funded training centers? And who can explain why it's so hard to get a good job? A 63-year-old man I met in Lake Charles, whom I will call Bill Beatifo, had a full crop of gray hair and a cherubic smile. As I came to know his story, I came to deeply appreciate his brave refusal to be discouraged. His passion was sales. "I cut my teeth in cold calling," he said. "Sold trucks through Ryder truck rentals, Kirby vacuum cleaners, Amish sheds, short-term health insurance, you name it. For 16 years, I had done really well as a salesman and sales manager." Then a watershed moment came in 1992. I was asked to fire some people under me. Then they got me. I'd been making $60,000. They said, we've got to cut you to $40,000, but you can make up the $20,000 in commissions. But that $20,000 was really a cut. So I quit. They were cutting the older employees because we were more highly paid. I felt betrayed, especially by a co-worker who knew what was about to happen, but didn't tell me. Then he tried to replace the job he had lost. I called, emailed, called, emailed, waited. I almost never heard back. They can tell how old you are from your resume. The longer Bill was locked out of jobs in sales, the harder it became. He went on unemployment. I was a 99-weeker, he said in a mirthless laugh, referring to maximum unemployment insurance. It was almost too long. You don't actually look for work every day. He applied for a full-time job stocking grocery shelves, but realized that at his age, 8 hours on his feet was too much. Bill found a part-time job as a bookkeeper at a nearby truck garage for $10 an hour, the same wage he had earned summers as a college student in a union-protected factory job 40 years earlier. He had applied for a job as a part-time guard at a gated community, which he didn't get. He also spent more time with what had long been a sideline, selling non-FDA-approved magnetic shoe inserts that get rid of aches and pains, and he had bought stocks in a company that was about to produce a medical device he hoped to sell to hospitals. He sold OrganoGold coffee, non-government certified organic, to friends and acquaintances, which his daughter feared was a scam. You have to buy it before you sell it. But Bill wasn't the type to give up. He could endure pain. I'm a capitalist, he said. When they get the medical device out of production and into the market, my wife and I will be millionaires. As with other men I spoke with, the repeated term millionaire floated around conversations like a ghost. Meanwhile, if men like Bill were being squeezed by automation, outsourcing, and the rising power of multinationals, they were also being squeezed by greater competition from other groups for an ever scarcer supply of cultural honor. As we shall see, the 1960s and 1970s had opened cultural doors previously closed to blacks and women. Even as immigrants and refugees seemed to be sailing past the Statue of Liberty into a diminishing supply of good jobs. And the federal government was helping this happen. After Clinton's 1990s claim to end welfare as we know it, rates of financial aid to the poor fell. But in response to the Great Recession, after 2008, welfare rose, mainly through Medicaid and SNAP, although these rates have peaked and are falling. On this, see Appendix C. Given trends in the economy and a more open cultural door, news of more government giveaways rang alarm bells. That was the squeeze. Not all white middle and working class men in this squeeze moved right, of course. But many self-starters, men who'd done well for what they'd been given, those in evangelical churches in right-leaning, rural, and southern enclaves, those who had emotionally endured, and the women who were like them or depended on them, were inclining right. Catcalls. Crazy redneck. White trash. Ignorant southern Bible thumper. You realize that's you they're talking about. You hear these terms on the radio, on television, read them on blogs. The gall. You're offended. You're angry. And you really hate the endless parade of complainers encouraged by a 1960s culture that seems to have settled over the land. On top of that, Hollywood films and popular television either ignore people like you or feature them, as in Buck Wild, in unflattering ways. Two missing front teeth, all raggedy, that's how they show us, one man complained. The stock image of the early 20th century, the Negro minstrel, a rural simpleton, the journalist Barbara Ehrenreich notes, has now been upgraded, whitened, and continued in such television programs as Duck Dynasty and Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. Working-class whites are now regularly portrayed as moronic, while blacks are often hyper-articulate, street-smart, and rich. You are a stranger in your own land. You do not recognize yourself in how others see you. It is a struggle to feel seen and honored. And to feel honored, you have to feel and feel seen as moving forward. But through no fault of your own, and in ways that are hidden, you are slipping backward. You turn to your workplace for respect, but wages are flat and jobs insecure. So you look to other sources of honor. You get no extra points for your race. You look to gender, but if you're a man, you get no extra points for that either. If you are straight, you are proud to be a married, heterosexual male, but that pride is now seen as a potential sign of homophobia, a source of dishonor. Regional honor? Not that either. You are often disparaged for the place you call home. As for the church, many look down on it, and the proportion of Americans outside any denomination has risen. You are old, but in America, attention is trained on the young. People like you, white, Christian, working and middle class, suffer this sense of fading honor demographically, too, as this very group has declined in numbers. You have the impulse to call out, "I'm part of a minority too." But you have criticized just such appeals for sympathy when others have made them on similar grounds. You feel stuck between a strong desire to be recognized for who you really are and all you've really done, and dread at joining the parade of poor me's. You want to rise up against these downward forces. There is a political movement made up of people such as yourself who share your deep story. It's called the Tea Party. Checking back with my friends. I return to my new Louisiana friends and acquaintances to check whether the deep story resonates with them. When I relate the story to him, Mike Schaff writes in an email, "I live your analogy. We pay hundreds of millions of dollars in hard-earned taxes for these bureaucrats at the Department of Environmental Quality and the EPA to do their job, and they do nothing of the sort. To add insult to injury, these slackers jump the line to retire before the workers who pay their salaries can. When the taxpayer finally gets to retire, he sees the bureaucrats in Washington have raided the fund, and the rest of us are waiting in line." When I relate it to Lee Sherman, he tells me, "You've read my mind." Janice Areno tells me, "You have it right, but you've left out the fact that the people being cut in on are paying taxes that go to the people cutting in line." Another comments, "You didn't finish the story. After a while, the people who were waiting have had it, and they get in their own line." And yet another adds, "That's it. But the American dream is more than having money. It's feeling proud to be an American and to say under God when you salute the flag and feel good about that. And it's about living in a society that believes in clean, normal family life. But if you add that, then yes, this is my story." In his interviews with Tea Party members in New York, Jersey City, Newark, and elsewhere in New Jersey, the sociologist Nils Kumkar found spontaneous mention of the idea of annoyance at others cutting in line. In their interviews with Tea Party advocates in Massachusetts, Virginia, and Arizona, and in their 2011 examination of nearly 1,000 Tea Party websites, the sociologists Theda Scotchpole and Vanessa Williamson also reported attitudes toward blacks, immigrants, public sector workers, and others, parallel to those I found here. Many spoke of sympathy fatigue. Liberals want us to feel sympathy for blacks, women, the poor, and of course I do up to a point, one kindly restaurant proprietor explained. I hear stories and they break my heart, but then sometimes I don't know if I'm being had. I get men applying for a job, I give them a job, and they don't show up. Is it just to put on their record that they applied and can continue on unemployment insurance? A woman came up to me at Wendy's saying she had 2 children and was looking to pay for a hotel because she was homeless. I asked her where her children were. Oh, they're with Mama. Well, then, aren't you living with Mama? A man from the Red Cross came asking for food for Sunday dinner for the homeless. I gave it to him, because it's food. But I don't even want to go over there to see. Maybe they're not trying to be independent. I don't want to change my mind about giving the food. I want to give. But he wanted to do it on the understanding his recipients were trying to better themselves, a requirement he worried liberals left out. Behind the deep story, race. The deep story of the right, the feels-as-if story, corresponds to a real structural squeeze. People want to achieve the American dream, but for a mixture of reasons, feel they are being held back. And this leads people of the right to feel frustrated, angry, and betrayed by the government. Race is an essential part of this story. Curiously, the people of the right I came to know spoke freely about Mexicans, 4% of Louisianans were Hispanic in 2011, and Muslims, who accounted for 1%, but were generally silent about blacks, who, at 26%, were the state's largest minority. When the topic of blacks did arise, many explained that they felt accused by the North of being racist, which, by their own definition, they clearly were not. They defined as racist a person who used the N-word or who hates blacks. Mike Schaff did neither. Born on the Armalese sugarcane plantation, grandson of the overseer, he describes himself as a former bigot. I used to use the N-word, and a lot of black kids I played with did too. But I stopped that back in 1968. I remember yelling from the stands of my college football stadium in 1968, rooting for our best player, "Run, nigger, run!" And the next year, in 1969, I was yelling, "Run, Joe, run!" I haven't used the word since. I look forward to a day when color just won't matter at all. I think we're halfway there. As I and others use the term, however, racism refers to the belief in a natural hierarchy that places blacks at the bottom and the tendency of whites to judge their own worth by distance from that bottom. By that definition, many Americans, North and South, are racist. And racism appears not simply in personal attitudes, but in structural arrangements. As when polluting industries move closer to black neighborhoods than to white. Among the older right-wing whites I came to know, blacks entered their lives not as neighbors and colleagues, but through the television screen and newspaper where they appeared in disparate images. In one image, blacks were rich megastars of music, film, and sports. Beyoncé, Jamie Foxx, Michael Jordan, Serena Williams. Pro basketball legend LeBron James, they knew, earned $90 million from endorsements of commercial products alone. So what could be the problem? In a second image, blacks were a disproportionate part of the criminal class, and of its glorification in raunchy rap lyrics about guns, hoes, and bitches. And in a third image, blacks were living on welfare. But see Appendix C. Missing from the image of blacks in most of the minds of those I came to know was a man or woman standing patiently in line next to them, waiting for a well-deserved reward. Behind the deep story, gender. Gender, too, lay behind the disorientation, fear, and resentment evoked by the deep story. All the women I talked to worked, used to work, or were about to return to work, but their political feelings seemed based on their role as wives and mothers, and they wanted to be wives to high-earning men and to enjoy the luxury, as one woman put it, of being a homemaker. According to national polls, more men than women are Republican, or Tea Party, and more men, 12% in 2012, are members or supporters of the Tea Party than women, 9%. And even within these conservative groups, women are more likely than men to appreciate the government's role in helping the disadvantaged, in making contraception available, in equal pay for equal work. It was this range of issues, especially the need for parental leave, that had led me, as I note in the preface, on this journey in the first place. The women I spoke to seemed to sense that if we chop away large parts of the government, women stand to lose far more than men. For women outnumber men as government workers and as beneficiaries. I also noticed a curious gender gap within the right. When the conversation got around, as it inevitably did, to non-working people getting handouts paid for by workers further back in line, a gender divide emerged. When I asked one couple what proportion of people on welfare were gaming the system, the woman estimated 30%, while her husband estimated 80%. There, inside the Tea Party, was the gender gap. Despite this difference, women and men of the right voted in similar ways. And more than gender, those affirmative action women cutting ahead in line, they jointly focused on race and class. Behind the deep story, class, the federal government, and free market as proxy allies. One can see the experience of being cut in on by one group after another as an expression of class conflict. This is perhaps a curious term to use. Certainly, it is a term avoided by the right, and it is applied elsewhere by the left. But throughout American history, such conflicts have appeared in different theaters of life, with different actors and different moral vocabularies in play. Each called for deep feelings about fairness. In the industrial 19th century, the classic form of class conflict took place on the factory floor, between owner and worker, and the issue was one of fair recompense for work. In 1892, a general strike took place in New Orleans. Railroad conductors struck against management for the 10-hour day, overtime pay, and the right to unionize. Other unions joined in sympathy, white workers standing with blacks despite attempts to divide them. The Chicago Garment Workers Strike in 1910 against a management cut in the piece rate, or the 1934 West Coast Longshore Strike, all these took place between managers and workers, in a workplace, over pay, hours, or working conditions. Today, although many such strikes continue, the Walmart strike of 2012, for example, many industrial work sites have been moved offshore to Mexico, China, Vietnam, and elsewhere. Other forms of social conflict have arisen in different theaters. One theater animates the politics of the left. It focuses on conflict in the private sector between the very richest 1% and the rest of America. Occupy Wall Street has such a focus. It is not between owner and worker over a higher wage or shorter hours of work. It is between haves and have-nots, the ever more wealthy 1% and the other 99% of Americans. What feels unfair to Occupy activists is not simply unfair recompense for work, the multi-million-dollar bonuses to hedge fund managers alongside the $8.25 hourly rate for Walmart clerks, but the absence of tax policies that could help restore America as a middle-class society. For the right today, the main theater of conflict is neither the factory floor nor an Occupy protest. The theater of conflict, at the heart of the deep story, is the local welfare office and the mailbox where undeserved disability checks and SNAP stamps arrive. Government checks for the listless and idle. This seems most unfair. If unfairness in Occupy is expressed in the moral vocabulary of a fair share of resources and a properly proportioned society, unfairness in the right's deep story is found in the language of makers and takers. For the left, the flashpoint is up the class ladder, between the very top and the rest. For the right, it is down between the middle class and the poor. For the left, the flashpoint is centered in the private sector. For the right, in the public sector. Ironically, both call for an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. Left and right also seemed to ally with different sectors of society. It is almost as if those I talked with thought about the government and the market in the same way others think of separate nations. Just as various nations back different sides in a foreign war, fighting each other on a proxy battlefront, in the same way those I spoke with seemed to talk about the federal government and the free market. The free market was the unwavering ally of the good citizens waiting in line for the American dream. The federal government was on the side of those unjustly cutting in. Feeling betrayed by the federal government and turning wholeheartedly to the free market, the right is faced with realities the deep story makes it hard to see or focus on. Giant companies have grown vastly larger, more automated, more global, and more powerful. For them, productivity is increasingly based on cheap labor in offshore plants abroad, imported cheap foreign labor, and automation, and less on American labor. The more powerful they've become, the less resistance they have encountered from unions and government. Thus, they have felt more free to allocate more profits to top executives and stockholders, and less to workers. But this is the wrong theater to look in for the conflict that absorbs the right. Except when a company like Texas Brine causes a sinkhole like the one in Bayou Corn. And this may explain why much of the right isn't bothered by something else. The unaligned interests between big and small business. Many members of the Tea Party run or work in a small business. Oil company suppliers, trailer parks, restaurants, small banks, and shops. Small businesses are vulnerable to the growth of big monopolies. What is transpiring today, Robert Reich argues in Saving Capitalism, is that big monopolies support policies that help them compete against smaller businesses by rewriting property bankruptcy and contract laws that favor big business over small. Under recently revised bankruptcy laws, the billionaire Donald Trump can freely declare bankruptcy while insulating himself from risks to investment, while smaller businesses cannot. The choice is not, Reich argues, between a governed and an ungoverned market, but between a market governed by laws favoring monopolistic companies and one governed by those favoring small business. Ironically, the economic sector that stands to suffer most from big monopolies is small business, many of which are run by those who favor the Tea Party. It might not be too much to say that the embrace of the 1% by mom-and-pop store owners is a bit like the natural seed-using small farmers' embrace of Monsanto, the corner grocery store's embrace of Walmart, the local bookstore owner's embrace of Amazon. Under the same banner of the free market, the big are free to dominate the small. But it is very hard to criticize an ally, and the right sees the free market as its ally against the powerful alliance of the federal government and the takers. Even Lee Sherman, who had greatly suffered at the hands of Pittsburgh Plate Glass, owned stock in it, and exclaimed proudly to me when I asked him how he felt about getting fired, "I was pissed and stunned, but hey, I didn't lose everything. I had $5,000 in stocks." In the undeclared class war, expressed through the weary, aggravating, and ultimately enraging wait for the American dream, those I came to know developed a visceral hate for the ally of the enemy cutters in line, the federal government. They hated other people for needing it. They rejected their own need of it, even to help clean up the pollution in their backyard. But that kind of extraordinary determination takes a certain kind of person, a deep story self. 10. The team player, loyalty above all. "You can tell I'm a Republican," Janice Areno says as she invites me to sit down in her office. Elephants fill three shelves of a wall opposite her desk. One is blue and white porcelain, a second is gold, a third is red, white, and blue, and stands near a young child's drawing of a yellow one. One is shaped into a teapot, another holds an American flag. There are large elephants and small, wooden and glass. There are elephants standing and elephants trotting. Next to her awards for outstanding service to her community and photos of relatives, the elephants have been gathered over the years from bake sales, luncheon raffles, and Republican conventions. "I see an elephant. I feel proud of this country." I am seated across from Janice in her spacious office, where she has long worked as an accountant for Lacassagne, a land management company in Lake Charles. She is the daughter of Harold Areno's oldest brother, and she herself grew up not far from Bayou Din. She is a short woman with a purposeful handshake and a lively face who dresses in a no-nonsense gray pantsuit and practical shoes. She wears neither jewelry nor makeup. In this way, she dresses Pentecostal, as she puts it. But with her somewhat mannish outfit and close-cropped brown-gray hair, she explains, "In some ways, I don't dress Pentecostal." Her manner is direct, forceful, usually good-humored. Across the desk, during our first of many meetings, she punches out a series of well-articulated opinions on a wide range of issues, and then comments humorously, aside, "You get me talking about all the burrs under my saddle." Then she quips, "Maybe I'll visit you in Berkeley and you can introduce me to naked hippies." A blizzard of papers covers her large wooden desk. "Tax season," she explains. "I do returns for the cleaning lady and the computer guy free, and I just finished taxes for the daughter of a coworker." She's also been calling around to everyone she knows to donate food and furniture to a friend's relative, a soldier who had just returned from a second tour in Iraq to discover that his wife had abandoned their three small children. The oldest was feeding the younger ones remnants of stale cereal. Janice had joined her church's compassionate effort to rally around the man. We joke. On a later visit to Lake Charles, I bring her a San Francisco 49ers cap. She is an ardent Dallas Cowboys fan. She tells me she'll wear it deer hunting, but can't promise to root for the 49ers. In truth, her home team is the right wing of the elephant, the Republican Party. Her loyalty to it defines her world. 61 and single, she is devoted to a large extended family and notes proudly, "I raised my sister's kids like my own." One nephew, now grown, lives in a trailer on her property and is helping her construct rooms in her large new home to accommodate one sister, maybe two, and anyone else it works out with. At Lacassane, Janice is usually the last to leave the office at night. She oversees the management of 21,000 acres of land, long ago part of a rice and soybean plantation. Throughout the years, the land has also been leased for hunting and oil and gas exploration. Lacassane also runs a large hunting lodge called Jed's Cabin, licenses underground pipeline rights of way, and manages timber. I asked Janice if we could visit her former school, church, and home in Sulphur just west of Lake Charles. We leave her office, walk into the parking lot, and climb into her silver SUV. Fishing rods rattle in the back, along with a 3-pound bag of pecans, crushed but not shelled, that she plans to give away to friends. Sulphur is an industrial town of 20,000, built in the 1870s. Out of the car window, I see signs of many other lines of work in Louisiana. Richard's Boudin and Seafood Market, Sulphur Pawn and Discount Center, Bebop's Ice House, Lumber Yards, Barber Shops, Family Dollar Stores, Walgreens, J.C. Penney, Payday Loans of Sulphur, and Easy Cash. As we head for her old school, she begins to describe her childhood. "I was born in the middle of the pack, fourth of six. My dad was the oldest of 10, and my mom was the youngest of 7. And everyone married and had kids. On Daddy's side alone, I have 46 cousins, and on my mom's side, it's about the same. One of my mother's sisters had 11. Like many of those I talked to, Janice describes her childhood as poor but happy. My mother was a homemaker, but boy, she cooked up a storm morning and night and washed for 8 in a wash house. I worked hard all my life. I started at age 8 and never stopped," Janice begins. In the course of her work life, she had learned to tough things out, to endure. Endurance wasn't just a moral value, it was a practice. It was work of an emotional sort, not claiming to be a victim, accommodating the downside of loose regulations out of a loyalty to free enterprise. This was a tacit form of heroism, hidden to incurious liberals. Sometimes you had to endure bad news, Janice felt, for a higher good, such as jobs in oil. I was discovering 3 distinct expressions of this endurance self in different people around Lake Charles: the team loyalist, the worshipper, and the cowboy, as I came to see them. Each kind of person expresses the value of endurance and expresses a capacity for it. Each attaches an aspect of self to this heroism. The team loyalist accomplishes a team goal, supporting the Republican Party. The worshipper sacrifices a strong wish. The cowboy affirms a fearless self. Janice was a team loyalist. Janice has not left her love of rural life behind. "I learned to handle a shotgun when I was 6, picking off cottonmouth and copperhead snakes from a boat," she tells me. "Now I hunt deer, duck, and boar in season, and I fish on weekends. My daddy used to say, 'If you shoot 'em, you clean 'em and eat 'em.' Until I was 40, all my brothers and sisters did that. Now I take the meat to be ground into sausage." We pass Janice's elementary school, named after the German scientist Hermann Frasch, who developed a method of mining sulfur. Her high school's official emblem was a miner's hard hat, crossed pick, and shovel. Its school colors were red, white, and blue. Janice had been in the Honor Society and 4-H, and she was a leader on the debate team, following that up with a BA from nearby McNeese University and a career in accounting. Her father had not been so lucky, she told me. As the oldest of 10, he was forced to quit school early to help his father raise a garden to feed a family of 12. We stop in front of Janice's church, get out, pop the trunk, and carry in boxes of cups, plates, and hand wipes. These are to be used at a church supper to raise money for our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. People have stopped giving money for our boys, but they're still over there, she said. We still have to care. We get back in her SUV and drive on. Janice's talk of family focuses mainly on her father. He had a third-grade education and supported a family of 8. He could do a lot of things, like mend a hole in fishing net like no one you ever saw, she says. At 19, he learned pipe fitting, joined the local union, and worked for more than 30 years at Cities Service, now CITGO. He was never on disability or unemployment, she says proudly. He could never have supported us all without the opportunity to work at the refinery. After he retired, her parents drove their camper truck to Utah and Colorado, working as fruit pickers, and had lots of fruit, and I'm glad they got the chance to travel before he died. The SUV slows down, and we pass a modest building that hardly stands out from the homes across a hedge on each side. This was where, as a small girl, Janice belonged to a full gospel church, which refers to speaking in tongues, prophecy, and gifts of healing, and attended Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. No missing. Her grandfather had been a founding board member of this now relocated church. Her dad had been treasurer. Now Janice was chairman of its board. Diligence, industry, party. It was in church that Janice first learned the honor of work, she says. As an 8-year-old girl, I swept out the whole church by myself after Sunday and Wednesday services, and mowed the lawn. I cleaned out the bathrooms, the boys and the girls, in back of the church. My parents would drop me off and pick me up later. She kept that job as she grew older, but added another job at a Tasty Freeze stand. After high school, I put myself through McNeese, working 40 hours a week as a telephone operator. I worked 1:30 to 10 p.m., and 3 to 11 p.m., and 4 p.m. to 12 a.m. It was hard to work long hours and get up to go to school the next morning, hurrying to get your studying in between. I only had one weekend a month off, no summers. It was rough. After that, she got a job in the company she works for still. Janice is stoutly proud that, like her dad, she never took a dime from the government. For 5 years at the telephone company and 43 years here, I never one time ever drew an unemployment check or got any government assistance, she says. Adding, I did get a small student loan when I was going to college. Back then, the government didn't just give it to you, and I paid every nickel of it back. Getting little or nothing from the federal government was an oft-expressed source of honor, and taking money from it was, or should be, Janice felt, a source of shame. The sharpest burr under my saddle, Janice declares, is people who take government money and don't work. I know guys who work construction who quit so they can draw unemployment to hunt in season. It was the same with disability payments, she said. A friend's daughter has a husband who works long enough to get hurt and puts in for disability. My own cousins, uncles, and brothers have done it. Sometimes there weren't jobs. Then it's great to have welfare, she allows. But when there are jobs, why couldn't they mow a churchyard or fold clothes at a care center or clean out the school bathrooms? We pay them to do nothing. First, through TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, and now through SSI, supplementary security income for elderly or disabled. That's not right. They should do something to help. On this, see Appendix C. Work had been a passport out of fear, poverty, and humiliation for her father and others a generation back. But Janice doesn't base her own sense of honor or that of others just on money. She doesn't base it on how gifted she is in her work or whether her job makes for a better world. At least, none of this comes up. If people work as hard as she does, it is a better world. Her feeling about work is part of a larger moral code that shapes her feelings about those ahead and behind her in line for the American dream. Hard is the important idea. More than aptitude, reward, or consequence, hard work confers honor. It comes with clean living and being churched. Those getting ahead of her in line don't share these beliefs, she feels. Liberals, those associated with the social movements that brought in the line cutters, share a looser, less defined moral code, she feels. Liberals don't give personal morality itself its full due, probably because they aren't churched. Janice opposes abortion, except under certain circumstances, but imagines there are 50 million abortions a year, probably all Democrats. She pauses for a moment of dark humor. Maybe I should rethink that position. With Supreme Court approval of gay marriage, with federal welfare for the idle, with fewer Americans churched, with the PC amnesia concerning the heroism of the young boys who died for the South, however misguided the Confederate cause, her piece of America seems like a small, brave holdout against a national tide. The American dream itself has become strange, unbibled, hypermaterialized, and lacking in honor. Even as she stands patiently in line, she is being made to feel a stranger in her own land. The only holdout for the better aspects of the past is the Republican Party. If you have a job, you should apply yourself to it, even if you face a little risk, Janice feels. Two of my brothers are pipe welders, and the guys they work with would stop work for small stuff, she complains. On one job, the guys were welding aluminum. It helps to counteract the fumes you inhale if you drink milk, so the company brings them 10 o'clock milk. It's in the union contract. If the company didn't bring them their milk at 10 o'clock, 30 guys would wobble the job, stop working. Now, is that stupid or what? It wouldn't have killed them one day. They could have brought their own milk. Janice's was a company perspective. For a period, she worked for the Lake Area Industry Alliance, visiting schools to explain the benefits of industry to students who might be getting another story from home or from the liberal media. Work has a disciplinary function. If there aren't jobs around, well, get people working on the highways, using wheelbarrows and shovels instead of all the dump trucks, she says. When people got home at night, they'd be tired and wouldn't be out drinking or doing drugs. Janice had even cooked up an imaginative scheme to bring jobs back to America. America needs to dig up every rock and every headstone of American veterans of World War II buried in France, which hasn't been a good friend to us, she declares, and bring them back to American land and let American workers mow the lawns around them with American lawnmowers. If we can't substitute wheelbarrows for dump trucks or import cemeteries to bring morality to the idle, her thoughts turn to war. I'm not advocating war so people can work, she adds hastily. But there's a positive side to the war. Manufacturing missiles, Humvees, sewing uniforms. It's work. Not everything in Sulphur concerns work, she tells me. We are coming up on an enormous fairgrounds, part of Sulphur's newly built arena and events center, with a 14,000-square-foot ballroom for Mardi Gras and a rodeo arena for the Silver Spurs Rodeo Barrel Contests, where riders steer horses around barrels, and steer roping contests. On rodeo days, parents don't just drop their kids off and pick them up later, Janice says. These are family events. Janice understands the fix the idle are in. Welfare gives them more than an available job would. You can get an $8 an hour job and maybe clear $250 a week, she says. With welfare what it is, it's not worth it to get a real job. However, she and others like her speak of seeing, with my own eyes, parents driving up in Lexus cars to drop their children at a government-supported Head Start program. The government is trying to get her to feel sorry for people like that, Janice feels. She's not having it. Get a job. Looking away from the wheel for a moment, Janice stares at me with eyes wide, preparing for my shock. Some people think I'm too hard-nosed, she declares. But I think if people refuse to work, we should let them starve. Let them be homeless. That 44% of the Louisiana budget that came from the federal government, much of it for welfare to the poor, she would just as soon give back. Giving money in return for nothing? That broke her moral rule. Reward for work. So for her, there was no paradox in Louisiana coming in 49th in the Human Development Index and 50th in overall health and right-wing resistance to the idea of federal government aid. They could have whatever rank they wanted if they didn't work. We stop at a drive-through Burger King to buy two Whopper Juniors, sit down to eat them with some large sweet teas, then head to Janice's dream house. Having grown up blocks away from Sitco, Janice has bought a plot of land in North Sulphur so as to be far away from the plants. A retirement barn, as she calls it. She is constructing it room by room with the help of her nephew, who is planning to live there too, with his family. As we drive along, a call comes in on Janice's cell phone with a deafening clang. Her nephew is checking in about a plumbing fixture. With my questions about the great paradox, I am myself another burr under Janice's saddle, but I ask her my ultimate question. What about children born poor? Is she so indignant about idle parents that she won't reach out to the child? Does she oppose Head Start or subsidized lunch? I would hope that the child would say, I'm going to work hard and get me an education and good job and get myself out of this environment, Janice answers. Beyond that, her solution is to get children churched and to limit the fertility of poor women. Some people say I'm too hard-nosed, she says again. But after one or two children, I'd have her tubes tied. Wouldn't that be the federal government acting as big brother? I prod. No, she answers. She could decline to have her tubes tied and decline federal money. Underlying Janice's reasoning is her idea about inequality itself. Some people may just be destined to remain at the end of the line for the American dream. That's why she opposes redistribution of tax money from rich to poor. The fix wouldn't last. 10% of the people have 90% of the money, okay? She says. But if you even it out, in a year, even in 6 months, 10% of the people would still have 90% of the money. A lot of people who win the Powerball $247 million jackpots are bankrupt a decade later. They can't ward off beggars and cheats and don't know how to invest. We each have to find our own niche and learn to be happy where we are. Not only does the federal government give too much, It does too much and owns too much, she feels. We only need it to handle military and diplomatic matters and to build roads and dredge waterways, she says. As for government ownership of public lands, we should hold on to the Grand Canyon, part of Yellowstone, a few others, but sell the rest of the national parks for development and jobs. The government also controls too much. Guns, for example. Without imagining her view would surprise me, Janice argues that handing out guns is the best way to create democracy in the Middle East. If everybody had a gun and ammunition, they could solve their own differences. There are dictators because the dictators have all the guns and people have none, so they can't stand up for themselves. If the government takes our guns away, the same thing will happen here, she predicts darkly. Others echoed her sentiment. When Obama first took office, rumors spread that he would take people's guns away, and stores around DeRidder, Lee Sherman told me, sold out of ammunition. Another man told me that a minister even led his congregation to Walmart to stock up. The number of federal workers also seems to her plumb out of whack. She doesn't venture a guess, but many I interviewed estimated that a third to a half of all U.S. workers were employed by the federal government. A common estimate was 40%. Not knowing the figures myself, I looked them up. In 2013, 1.9% of American workers were civilian federal employees, and that percentage has declined over the last 10 years. For more, see Appendix C. Many government workers waste taxpayer money doing useless work, she feels. Here, Fox News offered her a rich supply of can't-top-this examples. First, there was Solyndra, a solar company that wasted a $535 million federal loan. Then an EPA worker was caught watching 4 hours of pornography films on a government computer, one called Sadism is Beautiful. Then there was the National Endowment of the Arts-funded painting, in which the artist Chris Ofili attached cow dung to the figure of the Virgin Mary. That stuff disgusts me. We had returned to her SUV and were heading back, fishing gear still rattling in the back. Okay, we're a free country, she says, but not that free. Maybe you can make a picture of Christ out of cow manure if you want to. You can make one of Muhammad out of cow manure if you want to. Or you can make one of Buddha out of manure if you want to. But don't let my tax dollars pay you the money to do it. You go out there and shovel that manure on your own. To Janice, the other team was behind the failed Solyndra, the EPA's Sadism is Beautiful man, the manure artist. Not her team. No way. Faces in line. It is not just the moral laxity of the Democrats that galls Janice, but the imposition of such laxity on her. She is badgered for sympathy, she feels, and made to feel bad if she doesn't grant it. Take sexual orientation and gender identity. If you're gay, go be gay, just don't impose it on me, she says. When I suggest that gay people aren't imposing a gay lifestyle on her or others, she counters, oh yes they are, and cites the example of Chaz Bono, the child of pop singers Sonny and Cher, who was born a girl but later changed sex to become male. Janice had followed the story closely. He was the cutest little girl on the show when I was growing up. When Cher's son said it would have been easier to grow up if she-he had not experienced prejudice, I think Chaz was forcing his way of living on me. He wants the whole world to change, so it will be easier for him to grow up. So I say, go be a man if you want to, go be gay if you want to. I don't mind somebody being gay if they want to be gay. Just be a regular person, go to work, mow the lawn, fish. You don't have to be shouting it from the mountaintops. Don't make me change, and don't call me a bigot if I don't. That's how we're portrayed. Cher Bono said on the Jay Leno program that the Tea Party are fucking nuts. And that's the consensus in liberal Hollywood. I return to an issue closer to her home. Industrial pollution in Bayou Din, where her uncle, Harold Arino, and his wife, Annette, live. My grandfather homesteaded those 40 acres before anybody even knew what a refinery was, she muses. It's all killed now. It makes me not want to live in Bayou Din, and makes me sad. Industry had brought 4 toxic waste landfills to Sulphur, one only a block from her present home. But they make what we need. Plastic soda bottles, rubber-soled shoes, toothpaste. We need toothpaste. Being a team player meant braving problems. To do so, Janice did a kind of work she didn't even count as work, the emotional work of accommodating such things as nearby toxic waste landfills, which in her heart of hearts she never would choose to live with. Sometimes, team players had to suck it up and just cope. The Rubberized Horse. Janice and I stop off at a cousin's house to meet her nephew, Dickie. Janice's sister is along, too. Janice had earlier told me a shocking story about a relative with a horse, and I wanted to talk with him directly, to hear the story again from him. I sat with Dickie, Janice, Janice's sister, and a cousin around a small kitchen table to hear a well-worn story that still evoked sadness and surprise. Now a retired school teacher, Dickie had been a young boy in the 1950s. I was riding my Palomino horse, Ted, he recalls. Normally, Ted cleared ditches 5 feet across just fine, but this time the horse fell back into the water and sank down. He tried to climb up, but couldn't. We tried to pull his reins, but couldn't get him up. Finally, my uncle hauled him out with a tractor. But when Ted finally scrambled back out, he was coated all over with a strange film. I hosed him off, but that only hardened the film on him. It was like a terrible glued-on wetsuit. It was like rubber. The vet tried, but couldn't save him. And Ted died 2 days later. The ditch was downstream from a Firestone polymers plant. Dickie was heartbroken at the time, and it still shows as he tells the story. But Janice recalls the episode slightly differently. It saddens her, too, but she doesn't allow her sadness to interfere with her loyalty to industry. She shakes her head as if to say, "We sure did put up with a lot of things back then. But let's not linger on too much bad news the way environmentalists do." As a child, she recalled hearing a great roar and seeing the daytime sky turn black. It was an accidental explosion at Cities Service, now Citgo. "We all thought the world had come to an end," she says. But that was then, she thought. Today, industry is in compliance with state-issued permits, and she sees no problems. We leave Dickie and Janice's sister and drive on. After a while, Janice turns the SUV off the pavement onto a dirt road that winds between 2 large ponds. We are coming up to the barn, her dream retirement home, built on 40 acres of former lumber company land, 6 miles from the Sasol expansion. "I've stocked my left pond with catfish, and I'm digging the pond on the right now." "We love to fish," she says proudly. She parks before an enormous building covered by a long, flat, tin roof. The house isn't finished yet, but a rock garden in the front is already surrounding a small water fountain, a tiny peacock figurine, and 2 elephant statues, black and white, one with trunk upheld. 2 deck chairs overlook the scene. "My sisters put that together," she remarks, chuckling. Although single and childless, Janice has built a 6-bedroom, 4-bath estate with a large, common family kitchen living room where the whole clan can gather. The refrigerator is stocked with sodas. This barn can house her 2 sisters, Joyce, who is recovering from hip surgery and is ready to move in, and maybe Judy, who lives in Texas, should she become widowed. Her nephew Kelly, helping to build the place, has his trailer on the premises and has just brought in a basket of fresh eggs along with a report that 1 chicken has died. One day, he, his girlfriend, and his daughter, Mattie, of whom he has half-time custody and whom everyone adores, might move from the trailer to the house. In back of the barn is an RV shed, a potting shed, Joyce loves plants, a chicken coop, a yard for 2 goats, and a paddock for 12 horses. "And we have dogs," Janice adds. All along the backside of the barn is an enormous rodeo arena where Mattie, when she's older, can practice ropes and barrels. "I wasn't interested in a fancy place," Janice explains. "Just serviceable, where we could all come." Weekends, you can see her atop her riding mower, cutting grass on 8 of her 40 acres. As I walk around Janice's American Dream house, I begin to understand how the deep story makes sense to her. She had made it out of the structural squeeze, aiming high on one side, facing a flat wage, uncertainty, competitors, and government aid on the other. Maybe her salary hadn't advanced in leaps and bounds, but she'd gotten to the head of the line. And man, oh man, that had been hard. You couldn't be some wilting violet. Along the way, it hadn't been so easy enduring surprise explosions, noisy machinery, and strange odors. To live with it, Janice managed anxiety nearly hidden to her, anxiety that now felt like second nature. It kept her steady and brave. It kept her focused on the good news of Sitco for her dad, Lacassane for herself, the buckle in the energy belt, the free market. She felt loyal to capitalism as it worked through the petrochemical plants of Sulphur, Louisiana, the system that produced the miracle of her father's wage and her own. She wanted others to want to feel loyal to it. Wasn't it obvious? What else, besides family and church, was there worth feeling loyal to? Such devotion wasn't respected, she felt. Indeed, she had to defend that devotion from a liberal perspective, which she associated with a morally lax, secular, coastal-based culture. It was one thing for certain categories of people to cut in line, but it was another to have false notions of the good and the true gain popularity and edge out her truer ones. Instead of the country agreeing with her community on the natural rightness of heterosexual marriage as the center of family life, she was now obliged to defend herself against the idea that these views were sexist, homophobic, old-fashioned, and backward. She also needed to defend her notion of the line itself. She didn't want to appear to critics as hard-hearted regarding the poor, immigrants, Syrian refugees. They simply shouldn't be ahead of her in line. Not only her values, but even the kind of self she proudly exhibited, an endurance self, seemed to need defending, because it too seemed to be going out of fashion along with all the blue-collar jobs. "They used to brag on my dad at the plant that he was so reliable and steady," Janice tells me proudly. But what did that count for anymore? Like her father and uncle, Harold Areno, Janice feels proud to have a rooted self, a self based in a busy, dense, stable community of relatives, co-parishioners, and friends. A newer, cosmopolitan self, one that seemed uprooted, loosely attached to an immediate community, prepared to know a lot of people just a little bit, a mobile, even migratory self, this seemed to be coming into vogue. Such a self took pride in exposure to a diverse set of moral codes, but did a person with that kind of self end up thinking, anything goes? It was frightening. It was wrong. And Janice was having none of it. She was doing yet more emotional work, disregarding the downside of life in the buckle of America's energy belt. She was focused on the upside. Industry was a loyal friend to her, and she to it. As for pollution, a company has a job to do. It's making things people want and need. Just like people have to go to the bathroom, plants do too. You can't just say, don't do it. But while she sided with Citgo, with Sasol, with Monsanto, and other companies in the state, Janice felt obliged to set aside problems she knew existed, but had decided to accept. After I'd known her for several years, Janice told me that her sister, Joyce, a warm-hearted woman, was planning to move in with her in her new home. Joyce had worked for Olin Chemical as a shipping supervisor, checking train cars that had been filled with phosgene, used in making pesticides, and at room temperature a poisonous gas, without a facial mask. She began to suffer from a debilitating autoimmune disease, had to cut her hours, and struggled to get better with prednisone and naturopathy. Janice herself also suffered from an ailment that she says is probably related to growing up near the plants. She was thinking of getting her blood checked, but she wasn't letting herself get all anxious about it. Janice is already hosting monthly cookouts for the Areno clan. We had 67 people for a Good Friday cookout, she says proudly. We have big cookouts at least once a month, 25 if you barely mention it, more if you spread the word. If we've got enough food, you eat. If the pots are bare, you didn't get here in time. Even as pine forests have given way to vast industrial compounds, and voters of the South have shifted right, Janice Areno is carrying forward the best she can from her roots. A loving family, ropes and barrels, catfish fishing, deer hunting, and y'all come cookouts, with the fruits of a BA and forbearance. She credits her team, her party, and the industry she feels it represents, with all her good fortune in life. She's a team loyalist. She originally moved to North Sulphur to escape the plants, but construction soon began on Sasol's new ethane cracker only 6 miles away. If Sasol has a major fire or explosion, we'd be subject to it, she says philosophically. And with the fracking boom, other new plants might be creeping closer in the future, too. But hey, you're subject to earthquakes in Berkeley, California. Things happen. In the meantime, anyone can stretch out in a deck chair in front of Janice's new home, by a small fountain, and see an object of great loyalty. Pudgy white foot mid-air, tusks and trunk aloft. 11. The Worshipper, Invisible Renunciation. Sunday's my favorite day, Jackie Tabor tells me, as if offering me a key to her whole life. We have just driven home from Sunday services at Trinity Baptist on my third visit with her. Her husband, Heath, has parked the tan SUV in the carport beside their high-riding Arctic Cat all-terrain vehicle, with its large, deeply grooved tires muddied by his recent hunting trip. Jackie is a petite, svelte, youthful 45, with shoulder-length dark hair, gold stud earrings, a pink cotton top and flats, casual dress, and intense dark eyes. She walks me through the hallway of her spacious home, restraining her excitable German shepherd, calming other dogs as we pass a hamster cage in her children's playroom. We enter a high-vaulted living room where three antlered buck heads stare ahead from above a large stone fireplace. The drywall behind them? Heath did all that and shot the bucks, she says, her eyes proudly wandering around.